I'm an art historian, and I've been working on 19th century American art for quite a while. We had an exhibit some years ago at the Philadelphia Museum of Art and the Cody Museum on an artist named William Ranney. He's a mid-century genre painter and history painter. And the person who paid for the whole thing came from the Philadelphia area, and that's how we got into the Philadelphia Museum. And she had a party the night before the opening for some of her favorite friends and her family. She had five children, and each child, it was at the Radnor Hunt Club in Paoli. And she had, each of her children had a table of 8 or 10, and then a number of her other friends were scattered around the room. So there were 50 or 60 people there. And so I gave this talk about William Ranney, and when you look at 19th century paintings, a lot of them are meant to tell you a story, to give you a moral kind of assessment of the times. They're more than anecdotes. They are really memorable comments, commentaries, in a sense, pictorial commentaries on the time. And so I was going on and on about this painting, about the sub-meanings that we as 21st century viewers walk by these paintings and said, oh, look, there's a guy sitting in a chair by a fireplace and his dog's asleep, and isn't that a nice thing? But it's really all about politicians of the time and how they have no notion of what's going on around them, and the dog is exemplary. Anyway, the lecture was over, I left, and I was walking out with the funder, and one of her youngest daughter, Caroline, had a table, and she was leaning forward, talking to her friends, and she said, you know, he just made it up. He made all that up. So that's what you're in for. Here. This is a talk about Albert Bierstadt and Thomas Moran. I talk a lot about Frederick Remington and Charles Russell. And so if I say Russell, that means... It means that I'm talking about Moran, and if I say Remington, it means I'm talking about Bierstadt. Okay, so just keep that in mind. But this is a talk about these two guys, and so the room is not divided really right in half, but I like to see the people over here be Bierstadt fans, and the people over here be Moran fans. Would that work for a while until we get partway through this talk? And then you can make up your own mind by the time we get done, okay? So this is the painting that Moran painted in 1872. It's very famous, and it was sort of the standard bearer of a great event in American history, and that was the founding of Yellowstone National Park, the first national park in America, in the world. It was a great signature piece, and he painted this, and Congress, which felt so happy, patting themselves on the back for having done this, bought this painting for $10,000. Okay, a lot of money in 1872, you think. Our story actually starts in 1881, 9 years earlier. And this is a book that was published in 1881. This is the 85 edition. And it's about travel on the Transcontinental Railroad and how comfortable you would be traveling all the way to San Francisco. You even can sing in the chorus with an American Indian. It's very, very fashionable to do, I think. And... So this is talking about how you get to the West and how easy it is to get to the West. And about three pages into the book, there is this series of portraits of the great white men. They're all white men, of course. The great white men who have conquered and explored and given us the American West through which you're now traveling on your train, okay? And we won't talk about the jerk at the top. But the guy in the middle is Ferdinand Vanderveer Hayden, and he was the one who was on the expedition, led the expedition, a geologist and an explorer. So it's good that he has a centerpiece, because he was sort of the discoverer of Yellowstone. And above him to the right is a guy named George Wheeler, who was a USGS guy, and the guy below him is John Wesley Powell, all famous explorers. And above Hayden on the left is none other than the Pathfinder himself, John C. Fremont, okay? And then at the bottom, there's a guy who looks like a Russian czar, and that's Thomas Moran. And next to him, the guy who looks like he just sat on a thumbtack, is Albert Bierstadt. So it's kind of interesting that by 1881, they are assuming that both Bierstadt and Moran have fit into this same category of a great American explorers and people who have promoted the West, so that you're riding the train and you're going to enjoy your experience. And remember that this experience is brought to you by Al or Tom. So riding on that train in August, mid-August of 1881, going west to go to Yellowstone, was a very celebrated contingent. And there happened to be a guy named General William Tecumseh Sherman, a guy who won the Civil War for the Union. Nice company, unless you're an Indian. His brother, the senator from Ohio, John Sherman, a guy who was just stepping down from the Supreme Court by the name of Strong, and another fellow named Hoyt, who was a very famous New York lawyer. And, of course, also on that trip was this fellow. Now, this is 10 years after Moran has gone and been the discovering artist and painted that picture 9 years earlier. This is Albert Bierstadt. He's gone for four reasons, and if I can remember all four of these reasons, you'll be really fortunate. The first was that he was sort of outdoors guy, robust. He liked to camp out and to ride horseback, and he liked adventures. And so he was really, and he was a hunter of sorts, and though he liked to paint more than he liked to hunt. But when he painted animals, he sometimes had to shoot them first. It's called dying to be painted. The second reason was that he really liked geology, and he thought he was sort of some sort of a amateur geologist, and the geysers, of course, were going to teach him all about geology. And he ran in some pretty big circles back east in New York, like Louis Agassiz, and some of the major scientists of the day were his friends. The third reason was that he wanted to, I don't know if he was a terribly spiritual guy, but he wanted to discover the sort of divinity, the inherent divinity of nature. And it was just kind of a Hudson River School kind of a thing to do. And if some people call these guys Hudson River School artists gone west. So, and he had sort of this Walden kind of thinking about nature. So he wanted to see if this is the heart of nature, and you can see it manifest there in the canyon, and you can see it in the geysers and stuff like that. And so he wanted to do that. And then the fourth reason, it was not the Department of Energy. How many people get that joke? Okay, I'll explain it to you later. was that he wanted to prove that Thomas Moran was wrong. He wanted to prove that Thomas Moran's watercolors and his paintings were way too heightened in color. And if you look at this painting of Old Faithful, it's very subdued compared to what we saw in the canyon picture, isn't it? He comes from a German tradition of painting, studied in Dusseldorf, and Moran came from an English school of painting, and studied in Philadelphia, but he was an admirer of English painters like Turner and Ruskin. And we'll get into that a little bit more. So those are the four stated reasons when he was interviewed by the New York Herald magazine or newspaper. Of course, he wanted to paint. And he painted the falls up close, and he painted the falls back from... And I just saw a painting today of another view of this. It's an original. It lives in your town here. Yeah, pretty amazing picture. Anyway, he took these sketches that he did, field sketches. He painted on cardboard, essentially, the thickness of a shirt cardboard, painted in oils in the field. And then he would blow them dry and stick them in these little boxes that had slots, and he'd hope they would dry before he got home. And when he got home, this is what he came home to. He had a studio in downtown Manhattan called the 10th Street Studio building, and there were 20-some studios in this building, so there were a number of other artists there. So he could have painted the larger pictures that he was going to conceive from these sketches there, or his little bungalow on the Hudson River, 47-room, with a studio about half the size of this auditorium. He could have painted it there, but this is what he came up with. And this painting's in the Cody Museum. And it says a lot of the same kind of things that if we analyzed that first picture by Moran, that it says this is a great American picture. Those diaphanous clouds show us the spiritual kind of qualities of nature that are hidden from us as mortals. So you're not supposed to see all of it. So some of it is not revealed to us as mortal humans. The trees, the big pine trees in the foreground, bow as if they're monks bowing to the altar of nature. He's making all this stuff up. But at any rate, and the waterfall is the font of American prosperity and nurturing, and the waters from this great lake called Yellowstone are coming here, and they're going to fall down this river and go to nourish the hinterland, okay? So there's lots of stuff going on in this picture that you and I just walk by and say, oh, another one of Yellowstone paintings. That's a pretty big painting. It's about 5 feet tall, not nearly the size of the Moran, but pretty good size. A couple of the sketches that he did of Fountain Geyser and Castle Geyser. Again, these are all painted in the field, in oil, on paper. And then when they were in there, they were on their trip from, I guess, maybe Fort Ellis. Is that Fort Ellis here? Okay. Fort Ellis, and then they rode on horseback into the park and around the park, and 3 months later they came out kind of whiskery, and there were no hotels. So you can see in the sketch and in the finished painting that was painted for that guy Hoyt, the lawyer, later on, it's a larger picture, that the camp is in the background. But he's interested in the geology and in the geysers. But this is the picture that we kind of need to focus on a little bit when we're talking about comparing Moran and Bierstadt, because this painting in Bierstadt's mind, had a very specific reason. And this was the reason. Everybody recognized this as a presidential library. Well, it's just like the presidential library today, except there are actual books in it instead of a flat screen television. He was a real promoter, and he wanted Congress to buy his paintings. And he wanted them to pay big prices for his paintings. And so he talked Chester Arthur, the president of the United States in 1882, into taking some of his paintings. And five of the paintings were of Yellowstone, and one of them was of the Sierras. And this was one of them. It hung right there behind the big white owl, stuffed owl. And if you went out that door and into the hallway, this painting, which also belongs to the Cody Museum, was hanging next to a huge painting of called Autumn in the Sierras, which would be called a grand painting. We'll be talking about that. At any rate, the story goes, and we read this in a Kansas City newspaper, that this guy Arthur, who kept walking through his library, and when he would finish reading his paper, he'd look up and see these paintings of Yellowstone. He said, I got to go there sometime. And he took this very celebrated holiday, and he went west, and he came up through Jackson Hole and the Tetons and came into Yellowstone in the summer of 1883. And there's some pretty celebrated characters here. The fifth territorial governor of Montana sitting over there, I think his name is John Schuyler Crosby. And he plays a fairly important part in this little story we're going to unfold here, and the guy on the far, the guy standing above him is Phil Sheridan, General Phil Sheridan, and his son, I think Mark or Matthew or something, on the far right standing. And the guy in the hat, the broad-brimmed hat on the far right is George Vest, and he was from Missouri. I think he was a senator from Missouri. And Vest was one of the guys who really promoted Yellowstone and called for attention to Yellowstone, for funding for Yellowstone. He was one of the most effective congressional members to really enforce the idea that this park was worth saving, not just by writing the Protection Act, but actually for preserving. So here's an artist who is going to play a role in one part of the Yellowstone story in terms of preserving it. And his name is Albert Bierstadt. So it's kind of indirect, isn't it? I mean, the president walks by your paintings, he likes it, he goes out here and he starts talking. You know what they talked about when they got out of the park? They said, you know what? There's no game in the park. There's no game in the park. And Crosby, or whatever his name is, this governor, passed a law in Montana saying we need to look at Yellowstone as a sanctuary for animals. before they disappeared. They were being poached to death. So we saw Moran's big painting. That was a summative exercise after it had been made a park, and Bierstadt later on dealing with another part of the park. Artists have been involved in this park business for a long time, and it goes back to the 1830s to a guy named George Catlin. And he went up the Missouri River in 1882 and again in 1832 and 1834, and he put together an Indian gallery, and this painting of the Upper Missouri was one of them. And on page 28 of this little booklet that he published on his Indian gallery, he called it, it called for the nation to pay attention and let's make the whole American West a great national park. The Indians and the buffalo and the territory deserve to be preserved. Of course, that didn't go very far, but it was a start. It was a good idea, George, and maybe it'll catch on. And it did catch on, and we go from 1838 to 1863. And here's Albert Bierstadt as a younger man, and he's headed west for his second trip to the west. He'd been out in 1859 to the Wind River Mountains in Wyoming, and now he was going out west to go with his friend Fitzhugh Ludlow, who was a brilliant travel writer. And they went through Denver, they went through Salt Lake, and they ended up in San Francisco. And a guy named Thomas Starr King. How many people have ever heard of Thomas Starr King? Well, he met them, and they got off the coach, and he said, "Welcome to California. I can see you guys are interested in nature, and you want to see nature in its most magnificent form. You need to go to Yosemite." And someday, he said, that will be a national park. And when they finished their tour, they were 7 weeks in Yosemite, painting pictures. These are sketches of Bridal Veil Falls. You see El Capitan in the background there. After they were done, they came back to New York, and he painted this little picture of looking down the Yosemite Valley with the sun setting in the background. And this painting, which is no bigger than 24 inches wide and 9 inches high, went on the market, and we'll take a look at that in a second. But it was his response to this incredible piece of divine architecture. That's what they called it. And when Ludlow and Bierstadt sat there on the rim looking down at this, they say, this is America's true Eden. This is America's divine, most divine spot. Neither of them have been to Yellowstone yet. So that painting and this article appeared in Atlantic Monthly, in the spring, March or April of 1864. The Civil War is roaring along, and this guy, Ludlow, says this is a very important opportunity for America. And notice down there it says, Star King is dead. Can you see that? And so he and Bierstadt need to do something, because Star King was the prime advocate of Yosemite being turned into not just a curious place, but a national preserve. Okay? And so they were pushing for it to become a national park. So this article comes out in the spring. And then in New York, at the same time, they have what's called a sanitary fair. How many people know what a sanitary fair is? There were huge fairs in Boston, San Francisco, Chicago, Philadelphia, New York. And they were to raise money for the wounded Union soldiers. So it was a precursor to the Red Cross, I guess, raising money for soldiers who had been wounded. And Bierstadt put his little painting in that exhibition. You can see his big painting called the Rocky Mountains on the far left in that sepia-toned photograph. The great big painting is the first painting he did when he came back from his trip to Wyoming. And this was the first painting, one of the first paintings he cleaned up and made into a finished thing beyond being a field study. And he hung it in this exhibition. And it commanded the highest price of any painting sold out of this whole benefit auction kind of an exhibition, and sold to a guy named James Lennox, the second wealthiest man in New York. Ever heard of the Lennox Library? Ever heard of the Astor Library? Well, the New York Public Library is the Astor and the Lennox Libraries combined. Okay? And this guy, Lennox, bought this painting, and it was a big puff in the paper. This is an important painting. If Mr. Lennox bought it, my God, it must be important. And so it comes to the guy on the right, John Hay. John Hay doesn't look like much of a guy. John, stand up straight, you know? You know who he was? He was the personal secretary to Abraham Lincoln. His best friend was Albert Bierstadt, the painter. He collected Albert Bierstadt paintings. His most famous and favorite author was none other than Fitzhugh Ludlow. He praised these guys. He was going to go on that trip, but this something called the Civil War intervened, and he had to stay home beside Al and get this thing solved. But in June, a bill came out of Congress to establish Yosemite as the first national park. And they copped out on it, but it was still federal land set aside for public enjoyment. They just let California administer it. Big mistake. But they did. And so Bierstadt had a role some years before Moran ever had a role in establishing at least the park idea, as getting as close to the dream that George Catlin had had way back 25 years earlier. And if you don't think he had a role, this is a painting he completed in 1864. And it's the same as a little painting, except blown up big size, okay? It's like 12 feet wide. In 68, he paints this picture, Domes of the Yosemite. It's 15 feet wide. And it's called what in the day was referred to as a great picture. And great pictures had four characteristics, if I can remember them. One was that it had to be big in scale. Number two, it had to sell for a lot of money. $25,000 is sold for to LeGrand Lockwood in Connecticut. Thirdly, it had to travel around. It had to go to various cities and be looked at by the public. You and I could go look at it. And we were handed opera glasses and little stools to sit on so we could look at the picture, all the details in the picture. This was the Dusseldorf School of grandiose sublimity. Okay? And the last thing it had to have was an engraving or a lithograph made of it so that you and I could buy it and take it home with us. So those are the four characteristics of great pictures. The first great picture was this one, probably the most famous American landscape painting in the 19th century. It was painted in 1857 or 8 by a guy named Frederick Church, who was Albert Bierstadt's competitor. This was a little earlier than Al got started. It was large. It was all about America and the power and the falls and the divine kind of sanction of the American way with the rainbow and all those 19th century symbols in it. And so this was it. And then it traveled. It sold for a lot of money in 57, $10,000. But that was a lot of money back then. And then he made a chromolithograph out of it. It's a beautiful chromolithograph. And he sold it with this little booklet that you see here. So that was sort of the beginning of this idea of great pictures. Well, we jump ahead to 1871. You ready for 1871? Now, Albert Bierstadt is living in San Francisco, and he gets a letter from a guy named A.B. Nettleton. And Nettleton is the sort of promotion agent for Jay Cook and his railroad that I think still goes through here. He wanted Bierstadt to go to Yellowstone with Hayden, and he would pay his way to make sketches of this so that Yellowstone could at some point be a stop along the way called Livingston today, and you could go into Yellowstone Park. And Bierstadt said, yeah, I'd really like to do that, but you know, I'm working on a great picture. And it was called Donner Lake, and his patron was none other than Collis P. Huntington. Pretty wealthy guy in California, happened to be in the railroad business also. So he had to turn it down, and so Nettleton sent a second letter, and that ended up in the mailbox of this guy, Thomas Moran. And Moran's 8 years younger. He's totally unknown, unheralded, we might say. And he's of the English tradition. He paints watercolors and then turns them into oils. He paints watercolors in the field. He's not the great outdoorsman that Bierstadt was. He had a pillow under his saddle. Or not under his saddle, on the saddle, under his butt. And he painted beautiful watercolors like this in the sort of Joseph Turner kind of feeling to them, very ethereal and beautiful and emotive. But really what he was into was fine, precise watercolors in the Ruskin, John Ruskin kind of pre-Raphaelite sense, where science and poetry inform your art, and every line needs to be replicated in nature. And so you can see the finished watercolors of the Great Blue Spring were important sort of replications of what John Ruskin would have called for. So these watercolors by Moran are packaged together, along with a set of photographs by his friend who he travels with. Instead of a travel writer like Ludlow, he travels with William Henry Jackson, the great photographer. And they sort of work things out together a lot. And of course, they're under the aegis of this guy named Hayden. And so the watercolors, the photographs, and the Hayden official report are handed over to Congress and circulated, and it was from those that they decided to pass the law that preserved Yellowstone Park. Moran was quick to claim the territory. By 1872, he's painting these watercolors, and not signing them T. Moran, it's T.Y. Moran, Thomas Yellowstone Moran. Okay? Bierstadt hadn't thought of that. It could have been A. Yosemite Bierstadt, but he never got into that. His pictures spoke for themselves. But at any rate, you can see that he's claimed the park, and he becomes sort of Mr. Yellowstone, at least as an artist. He gets famous enough, he buys a new house, he leaves Philadelphia, goes to Newark. Who would want to go to Newark? But he buys this house in Newark, and he paints this big picture, and it sells to Congress. And we've talked about the elements in the Bierstadt painting. They're all here repeated from those paintings by Bierstadt that he does later on. Except for one thing. Well, there are two things. Way up in the corner on the left is a bear. He's a little out of scale, but he's there, isn't he? And so Moran must have recognized some sense of animal habitation in the park. The other thing is the two fellows on the rock in the foreground, that's Hayden and probably some poor Crow Indian. You know, the Crow Indians used to own Yellowstone Park. They only got run out in 1872 when Hayden came along. And if you notice, Hayden is pointing out to this, and this is America's greatest achievement, preserving this. And you know, America at this time had a terrible inferiority complex. We had no, what were they called, ancient associations. We had no castles ruined. We had no viaducts from the Roman era. We had nothing until Hayden came along and said, our geology is our legacy. Our geology is our ancient history. And in fact, poor Frenchman, it goes way back beyond your viaduct. So he's very proud of this moment, pointing out to what this achievement has been. And the Indian, of course, is looking back at us saying, what the hell have I given up? We'll get into that theme a little bit later. So Bierstadt, at the same time, is trying to get this big painting. Remember the one that was hanging in the hallway? He tried in 1873 to get this painting bought by Congress, and it even went into the House of Representatives. It was on the floor of the House of Representatives. You can see it there. And he wanted $20,000 for it. And they said, we just paid Tom 10, and we don't have any money left. And so we had to take it home with him. So this painting, which we think of as a great American achievement and is the exemplar of Yellowstone, is not, in Bierstadt's mind, a great painting. It never traveled. It isn't big enough. It's only 12 feet. It didn't command a big price, did it? 10,000 puny little dollars? And he never made an engraving of it or a lithograph. So Bierstadt felt pretty good. I'll go back to my Yosemite pictures. And in 1868, he paints this picture, which has all those characteristics. So that brought $25,000. Moran says, I better go back out there to Yellowstone or out to the west. And he goes to the Grand Canyon with Powell in 1873, I think. And they go down the Colorado River, and he comes back, and he paints this picture. This is the chasm of the Colorado. And it's very sublime. It's very much like the Bierstadt domes of the Yosemite in terms of its character, in terms of its personality, in terms of its emotional power, much more so. But he's not going to leave that alone. In 1875, he follows Jackson, who had been there in 74, to the Mount of the Holy Cross in Colorado, and he paints this big picture. And he wants Congress to buy that one, too. They bought the Grand Canyon, actually. And so they had two of them for $10,000 apiece, bargain price. And they won't buy this one. But he dreamed of someday hanging the three of them together, because this would be the great American triptych. And the cross, the Christian symbol of conquering, manifest destiny, all that stuff is embodied in these three pictures. So that was done by 1876. Moran won't leave it alone still. He signs up with a guy named Louis Prang, who's a lithographer in Boston. And Louis Prang produces a portfolio of 18 or 20 Yellowstone, mostly Yellowstone pictures from his watercolor. The watercolor on the left, the chromolithograph, which is really exquisite work, on the right. And they were going to make a lot of money until the warehouse burned down. And so these portfolios are very rare. sad day. Bierstadt keeps plugging away. He sells the painting on the left to none other than Sherman. William Tecumseh Sherman. And the one on the right to the Sultan of Turkey. So he's continuing to use the imagery from Yellowstone to keep making a living. And, of course, Moran doesn't like that, so he goes back to Yellowstone. And he gets to the brink of the canyon, and he looks down and says, my God, this is still amazing. He goes and writes a letter to his wife and says, you won't believe it. It's as beautiful and as sparkling and as brilliant as ever. Like it was going to fade in 11 years? And he says, it inspires me, and I'm going to do a different painting. I'm going to do a better painting. No, he said, didn't say different. He said better. I don't have my notes, so I can't remember. He said, I'm going to do a better painting, I promise you. And he comes back. And that same year, in 1892, he has an exhibition of his watercolors at the Cooper Hewitt Museum in New York City. And the critics come to this exhibit and they say, these are lovely watercolors of the West. Tom, you've done a great job, except, you know, they're kind of illustrative. They should be in a magazine somewhere. This isn't real art. Oh my God, this isn't real art? John Ruskin told me this was real art. This is real art. George Ennis from New Jersey, he's a real artist. And he was denying everything that Moran stood for. Every detail of nature that he cherished and reproduced, every quality of his sort of connection between the photographer and the scientist that informed his work was abandoned when you think about what Mr. Innes wanted. What Mr. Innes wanted was painting should not have an intellectual underpinning. Painting should have an emotional underpinning. If it doesn't strike you emotionally, if it doesn't strike your chords emotionally, then forget it. And that's what he had, it was up against. That was the taste of the time. So when he comes back, that different painting, that better painting, whatever it is very much more muted than that 1872 painting. Very much richer colors. I think it's a stretch to say these are the same kind of qualities, but you can see the spirit in the painting is very much different. And so he paints another one of that same caliber. This was painted for a patron in Hawaii and is still in Hawaii today. A nice big picture, but he paints a great picture. It's like 18 feet wide, and he wants the government to buy it, and they don't. He even loans it full-time to the National Gallery, which was the precursor to the Smithsonian American Art Museum today. They keep it on loan, but they can't afford to buy it. And then he goes the next year back to Yellowstone, 1900, I think it is. He goes back and he says, oh my gosh, I've done this disservice. And he goes back and paints this big picture again in 1902 and livens it up. And that's why it's a little more lively than that one that went to Hawaii. There's the grand old man looking out at the canyon in 1900. And this painting was done within 3 years of his return. It's vivid. Do you vivitize something? I don't know. But he's really done a remarkable job of giving rebirth to that canyon. And so the repainting of the big picture was something that really engaged him to get closer to this, which was his spirit. That's the good news. The bad news is he signed up with Thomas Murphy from Ohio. Thomas Murphy was a lithographer, but he had none of the talent, none of the skill that Prang had in reproducing his work. And so they end up looking on the page like this. And it really does a great disservice to the original work of art. So we come to the end. We have to make our decision. Were we sitting on the right side of the room or the left side of the room? On the Bierstadt side or the Moran side? This is Moran's coup de grace as a painting. A real, genuine, great picture. This one, that's only 5.5 feet tall, is Bierstadt's largest painting. Is it hard to decide who's the better? If we have to decide. But as our friend Colombo said, wait, just one more thing. And this is the wait one more thing. This is Bierstadt's swan song. Bierstadt started painting this picture in 1888. And it is about Indians. It is about the Indian presence in the West. It's about the buffalo. It's about the buffalo's splendid numbers. When Bierstadt first went west in 1859, there were something like 15 million buffalo in the West. And by 1888, there were 500 left. 300 of them were in Yellowstone Park, and they were being slaughtered. And the rangers had no power to do anything but say, no, no, Mr. Poacher, you leave the park, nasty boy, and don't come back. They had no laws against it. So this is an interesting, we think this painting is Yellowstone. It kind of looks like Lamar Valley or the Hayden Valley. And the spread of the millions of buffalo coming off the hills and the buffalo hunt going on. And this climactic intersection between man and beast, and what the symbolism is that what happens to the buffalo happens to the Indian. In the foreground, I don't have a pointer here, but in the foreground, there are three buffalo who are dead or dying. One of them looks out at us. That's a device in 19th century painting called the returned gaze. Looking at you, the viewer, and saying, see what you've done. Look what you've done. And the most powerful of the return gaze images in this painting is the skull on the far left. And he's looking at you and say, this is what you've made of us. But behind the three dead and dying buffalo in the foreground is a dead horse and a dead Indian. So the buffalo die as the Indian dies. As the buffalo becomes extinct, the Indian is pushed to the reservation. The Indian cultures are diminished by the Christianization, education, and so forth, turning the Indians into farmers. When Bierstadt went west the first time in 1859, he came back with paintings like this, and that huge painting we saw in the early on in the sanitary fair display. This is a smaller version of that. Shoshone Indians in the foreground, the great Temple Peak and other mountains in the background from the Wind River Range. The Indian and the landscape are conflated. They are one. They are nature's children and nature's splendor combined. The critics wouldn't let him do it. They wouldn't let him paint Indians and landscape at the same time. You could do one or the other, but not both, because you diminish the painting by half when you try to do both. And so he turns later on in the 60s. If you remember the paintings of Yosemite, did you see any Indians? Those were done the same year he got critiqued. So in the 60s, he starts to incorporate buffalo into his prairie scenes particularly. You see the one on the top right is called the Buffalo Trail. And it's the halcyon days of the buffalo. This is the splendor. They're coming by the thousands out of the distance, crossing the River Platte, nourishing themselves. The river is a symbol in 19th century painting for regeneration and birth, coming out onto a green meadow shaded by the great cottonwood trees. This is as good as it gets if you're a buffalo, okay? 1869, he paints its pendant, which is called the Buffalo Trail, impending storm. And this is the year the Transcontinental Railroad has come across the West and split the buffalo herds in half. Their demise is spelled out for them. And so you see the one lingering buffalo in the foreground, a diminished herd behind him or her, probably her, him, I don't know, and then the rocks and the trees, not much sanctuary against this coming storm. And then in 1875, for the centennial in Philadelphia, he's going to exhibit a number of paintings, and this is one of them. It's called Western Kansas. And why does it become the part of his triptych in celebration of the buffalo? Because it is titled Western Kansas. And Western Kansas was the place where the hides were shipped to the eastern markets to be cut into industrial belts. And that's where the millions and millions and millions of buffalo went. And so West Abilene, Kansas in 1874, the year this was painted, the year after this was painted, year before this was painted, shipped 3,500,000 hides 1 year, just out of Abilene. So he understood what was happening. And when he realized that, because William Hornaday published a report that said there were 500 or 600 buffalo left in North America in 1881 or 1882 or 1883 or 1884 or 1885 or 1886 or 1887. Bierstadt realized that this was an important deal. And so did these two guys. George Bird Grinnell, the editor of Forest and Stream, probably the outdoor magazine of its day, and a guy named Theodore Roosevelt. And they formed in January, you can see the document here, in January of 1888, the Boone and Crockett Club. And you can see on page 6 of their minutes, I'm sure you can read it up there at the bottom of the page, it says, what we need to do, our first matter of real business, besides organizational matters which are dealt with in the first several pages, the first matter of real business is to preserve the herd of buffalo in Yellowstone Park. We have to get Congress to pass laws. One law had already come off the books in 1877, bipartisan law that was shipped to the desk of a guy named Ulysses S. something or other. And Ulysses S. something or other looked at it and said, and threw it in the trash can. This will stifle progress if we don't kill those buffalo off. So these two guys form this organization to preserve the buffalo. That's their first matter of business. So preserve. It was sort of an afterthought from the Audubon Society, which Grinnell had actually started 10 years earlier. That was for birds. Now we're talking about real animals, big animals. And Old Al, in 1888, you can see him here. Look at the list of members. President Roosevelt, or he wasn't president then, Theodore Roosevelt is the president of this organization, and the first charter member is a guy named Albert Bierstadt. So what's a guy like Albert Bierstadt going to do to further this cause of preserving the wildlife in Yellowstone? And he had been there and recognized that there were not many animals left, And Arthur had two, and Crosby had two. He paints a monumental allegory to the West and to Yellowstone and to the Indians who once resided there and to the buffalo that needed to be preserved there. And it's called The Last of the Buffalo. And there are two versions of it. This is the one that Cody owns and is in this exhibition that Steve talked about. And the other is at the National Gallery in Washington, D.C. They're about the same size. The one at the National Gallery, its history is kind of interesting. It was sent to Paris. So if you're a Grand Manor painter, you want a lot of publicity for your cause, and your cause is to preserve the Yellowstone bison. He gets a lot of press by shipping this big picture there, because guess what? It gets to the World's Fair in Paris. That's the year they did the Eiffel Tower. And there's a big American exhibit, and he submits this painting, The Last of the Buffalo, to it. And George Innes and a bunch of other jerks say no. This is too old-fashioned. It's too big. It doesn't leave us enough room for our paintings. This Al guy, he likes too much money for his paintings anywhere. Just no. And so he, had, in 1866, had been awarded the Chevalier of the Legion of Honor by the French king. And this award came with a big medal you could hang on your coat, and it came with the option that you could, any time you ever wanted to exhibit at the Paris Salon, you could. And so the painting went to the Paris Salon. And that whole story was unfolded in the New York and French and German papers. So he got lots of press on that. And when it was finished there, it went downtown to the Boussard Gallery. And it hung in the window of the Boussard Gallery. And he didn't sell it. It came back to America. It was made into an engraving, and then it went into, he gave it to his brother because he was having financial problems. So he gave it to his brother so it wouldn't enter a bankruptcy event that was about to happen. In any event, he had painted that picture because he was too elderly to go west again in 1888. He went from Manhattan to Staten Island every morning to paint buffalo and Indians. So what was going on in the summer of 1888 on Staten Island? Buffalo Bill and his Wild West show. And Buffalo Bill was camped out in Paris that summer. So he painted this big picture that we looked at of The Last of the Buffalo using models of Indians from the Wild West show and buffalo that he saw in the Wild West show. Here he is. Well, Bierstadt's not in this picture, but Buffalo Bill is, and in front of him is the most famous of all animal painters in France, none other than Rosa Bonheur, a little gray-haired lady. And beside them on each side are two Sioux Indians. One's named Rocky Bear on the left, and one's named Red Shirt on the right. And these were really famous guys in their day. In fact, they were so famous, when Rosa Bonheur invites a group of the Wild West team out to her estate in Fontainebleau, Buffalo Bill gets painted, his portrait here, in Fontainebleau, and the two Indians, Red Shirt behind, Rocky Bear in front. Look at that guy, Rocky Bear. He's taller than Buffalo Bill, and Buffalo Bill is no slouch. So in the cause of a great picture, he has the painting at the National Gallery engraved, so it's circulated that way. And he has the second version sent to London. And incidentally, 1890, the year he sends it to London and to the Hanover Galleries, this guy comes along, says, I'd like to have that for my little gallery out in, I can't remember the name of the city outside of, town outside of London, for my little estate out there. And he pays Bierstadt not 10, not 20, not 30, but $50,000 for this painting. The highest price ever paid for an American artwork in the 19th century. So Bierstadt's back in the chips. And you see the big painting there? I think it's the painting just to the left of it. But anyway, it hung in that gallery until Sir John Thomas North's demise. Then it was sold, and we have the catalog from the sale. I don't know how much it sold for. Didn't say that in the catalog, but we know it was the Cody version of it. So it had a big, I mean, when you sell a painting in 1890 for $50,000, you get a lot of attention. and Bierstadt right to the very end pushing this cause with his painting, The Last of the Buffalo. In 1894, another member of the Boone and Crockett Club, representative from Missouri, no, Iowa, he passes through Congress the Yellowstone Preservation Act, or something that's referred to commonly as the Lacey Act, in 1894. And your great historian from Montana, Michael Punk, who wrote a book about Grinnell, he said in one of his chapters about this act that in 1872, Yellowstone was an idea. It was a concept. It was an experiment. In 1894, Yellowstone was a commitment because it gave power to the park to deal with the poachers in a serious way. And so, again, once again, Bierstadt has a pretty significant role in this thing we call our national parks. So there they are. I don't know that there's any real difference except Bierstadt had a little more fastidious barber. But you make your choice, and my talk's over. Thanks.